Christina Borgeson with Celia Farber on the Whistleblower Newsroom.
Our guest today
is Cheryl Atkison, investigative reporter, former CBS Network correspondent, and current host of Full Measure. It's a Sunday TV program for the Sinclair Broadcast Group. She's also the author of the book Stonewalled, My Fight for Truth Against the Forces of Obstruction, Intimidation, and Harassment in Obama's Washington. She also wrote The Smear, How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, How You Vote. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start the show with just a couple of highlights from your book that really lit my hair on fire, I have to say, when I read it, just about the illegal computer surveillance and what was going on and why it occurred and who did it.
Well, I think that what we've discovered in the past 2 years is a pretty clear body of evidence that shows, while we don't know anything publicly about President Trump, evidence-wise, colluding with Putin, which everybody seemed very certain about a couple years ago, we have been revealed, or we have gotten revealed, a great deal of evidence showing alleged intel community abuses, not just against Trump associates in 2016 and President Trump thereafter, but also over a period of really the past decade or two that we know of. So it leads me to ask the question, with all of this, what I think is an intel operation going on against President Trump, even now, by people still in the intel community leaking and undermining him, is that to keep his nose out of looking at these very serious abuses that some insiders tell me should result in people inside the government being put in prison?
What have they detailed to you, the serious abuses?
Yes, even before 2016, I was told by insiders that the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, was being fairly routinely abused by FBI agents presenting improper or incorrect information that we never know about, because if you understand how FISA works, and I know a little bit of it from talking to these sources, you never see the basis on which generally a wiretap is granted. And these wiretaps are supposed to be used against foreign terrorists, but they've increasingly been used against U.S. citizens, and you don't get to see the premise that the FBI says they have for taking this extraordinary step by wiretapping U.S. citizens, because it doesn't usually go into a criminal court. It's a national security investigation. You never get to examine what they did. You don't even know about it, especially if they're allegedly gathering political dirt or blackmail material or something like that. You're never going to know they even had a wiretap necessarily, so you're not going to get to examine the material they gave to the court and how they got the wiretap. So I've been told for a long time that's been going on, and there's evidence of that in the record. And shortly after 2000, or the terrorist attacks in 2001, when Robert Mueller was in charge of the FBI was admonished by the FISA court for this very thing that I'm discussing. It's in writing. And the FBI promised to adopt new processes to try to avoid the FBI from presenting false or improper information to the FISA court. But according to my sources, it continued to happen.
Isn't a current example the whole business with the Steele dossier being used for a FISA warrant?
Yes, and let me explain why that's so important, according to the people I speak to inside the intel community. Some people say, well, what harm was it? Maybe it was unverified, but we later learned maybe some of it's true, some of it might have been true. What people don't understand is, in an order and a policy change around 2002, the FBI promised that it would never submit a single fact to the FISA court that was unverified, period. In other words, every step of the way up the line as these warrant applications are approved at the FBI and Department of Justice, they're supposed to personally make sure this information is verified, or, according to their own procedures, it's something called Woods procedures, they have to start over, go back and try to verify the information or leave it out. So the whole idea that an unverified dossier, even if it later had turned out to be true, was presented to the FISA court was in violation, I'm told, of their own rules and procedures, which could lead to some very serious, let's say, punishment if anybody were to care and look at that angle.
Cheryl, to what do you attribute this squalorous atmosphere that seemed to... When did it come in to the media and to the intelligence agencies? Are you, as far as you know, the first high-level journalist who was wiretapped in this unbelievably crazy way that's documented in your book? How did this happen?
Could you talk about that a little bit? We'll get back to the FISA court, but I really want you to talk about you waking up in the middle of the night and finding your computers being turned on. Could you talk just a little bit about that? I know you've probably feel like you've talked it to death, but people need to be reminded.
Well, and this is all related. I mean, the reason my case, I think, is important, which I'm fighting in federal court now against the government, isn't because I'm important. I'm not. I mean, I am to myself, but I realize, you know, I'm not on the international stage. But the point is, I think this happened to a lot of people, and I happen to know about it. I think a lot of people don't know what happened to them. I knew because I had intel sources alert me. I never suspected the government was spying on me or wiretapping me or getting in my computer. So I did have these episodes over a period of, gosh, a year or two, where strange things were happening with all my Verizon devices. My phones became inoperable, both the cell phone and the home phone. Couldn't use it with the buzzes and clicks and it connecting in other places, not at my house. I outlined this in my book, Stonewalled. The TV, the Verizon line was acting funny. The computers were turning themselves on at night by themselves. And I thought at the time, not understanding what the government could do, that maybe somehow spammers or phishers can come in and kind of steal your email list. I didn't really know why anybody would want to be in my computer. We now know from forensics, after I was alerted that I was probably being monitored for my work by the Obama administration, as were, I think, a lot of people, I learned through forensics that they had a long-term monitoring program that included keystroke monitoring, watching every keystroke I had made. They accessed the CBS system, the corporate system, a new system. They looked at my files and photographs. They used Skype, which I didn't know this. This is kind of scary. I have Skype on my computer, the app. And they can activate Skype in a way that's invisible to you, but to listen into your audio and conversations, you don't even know it's on. And they can also use Skype to exfiltrate files or to take files, you know, out of your computer and look at them. All kinds of things, including three classified documents were planted deep inside my operating system in a place that I would never, you know, I'm not a computer expert, would never even know existed.
Terrifying.
All of these things and five forensics exams by different independent people since then have mapped various aspects and origins of this effort with definitively. And one of them is, you know, we have government IP addresses that could not exist in my computer had not the government accessed it. And we know the routes and methods in some cases that they came in. We have dates and precise times in some instances. So,
what agencies were they, do you know?
Well, we know that they used U.S. Postal Service, sort of, I'll call them blank IP addresses that are sort of off the market, which is a practice. Now they can make, I'm told they wouldn't do it the same way today, or they're not. They can make it look like it's coming from Russia if they come in your computer, or it would track back to Abu Dhabi or somewhere
right.
else. But at the time, they were using blank IP blocks of IP addresses that were not generally used, and there's thousands and thousands of them with the post office. So the FBI or Department of Justice employees were utilizing the government IP addresses belonging to the Postal Service to get in, and that was one mode of access. There were several. They also used something called a BGAN satellite terminal, which can be set up a short distance from a target and access. We found a spare Verizon Fios fiber optics line on the back of my house, an Intel official that helped me kind of track all this down, that he says could be used to download information. And that may have been because our government's pretty good at working in the system of Windows and personal computers, but not so good with Apple. And I have a lot of Apple devices, so they may have had to use some alternate means to try to get into some of my systems.
Cheryl, is it clear to you which of all of your stories, you've done so many hard-hitting stories, it was, if it was one, maybe it was several, that set this off, this pogrom against you?
Well, I'll tell you what I know, and then I'll tell you theory. We know they looked at my Fast and Furious material when I was investigating Fast and Furious, because we can see that forensically. But my theory is they were looking at least a dozen reporters who were the most aggressive at reporting things that the administration didn't want reported or was sensitive about, and they were looking at everything we did just so that they could, number one, this is my theory, get out ahead of any reporting we were about to do so that they could spin it or discredit it or get on social media and start these fake grassroots comments to controversialize it. And number two, so that they could see what whistleblowers inside the government and what sources were talking to us. You remember this is the exact same time the Obama administration was under criticism for its war on whistleblowers.
Yep.
And so this all, I think, dovetails together quite nicely in the narrative of what happened.
What six reporters besides you do you think were targeted?
Gosh, I haven't really looked at it like that. At the time, I would say there were a couple at the New York Times, a couple at the Washington Post, maybe one other at a television news network.
No names?
Guessing, but
yeah, oh, okay. Okay.
Listen, it's been a while, and I don't even remember. I hate to say I don't read that much other people's work, but I was part of covering stories that only a handful of reporters would, investigative stories, would cover and take on. And I assume that in Fast and Furious, or whether it's Benghazi, some green energy stories they're very sensitive about, and some corporate stories that intertwine with the government, you know, government sensitivities, could have been any of those and any number of reporters that they were looking at. Now, one reason I have this theory, which is supported with some documentary evidence, there was an inside email leaked or published by WikiLeaks a couple of years ago that had two officials from Stratfor, which is called the shadow CIA government. Mm, yeah. It does kind of intel work, discussing, and I think this lays out the whole thing. It said that Brennan, who later became CIA director but was in another part of intel in the government at the time under Obama, that Brennan is behind, it said, the, quote, witch hunts of inside the Beltway journalists uncovering information negative to the Obama agenda. And then it went on to say there was even a specific tasker assigned at the White House to go after these people, which would be people like me. And you have to also know at the same time, the White House had people calling near daily, not just my bureau chief in Washington, D.C., but other officials at CBS to try to spin and controversialize and stop my story. So I was definitely high on the radar at the time.
Well, I mean, you are a real fly in the soup for Hillary Clinton because, you know, you were nailing the Benghazi story to the point where, I guess, Deputy National Security Advisor for Obama for Strategic Communications, Ben Rhodes, indicated that the PR goals for the narrative was fabricated for political reasons, that they wanted to, you know, when they lied about how Benghazi started. You remember they said that Benghazi started with a protest.
Yeah.
A protest. And he said, we have to underscore that these protests are rooted in an internet video and not a broader failure of policy. And so,
right now, at the time I was assigned to investigate Benghazi at CBS, we had no idea what we were going to uncover. We just knew they weren't being forthright. There were a lot of details that seemed to conflict one another. But yes, the story that was told over the subsequent year or two was a massive misdirection and cover-up by top officials who knew immediately that it was a terrorist attack and turned away or failed to send resources that were nearby that could have gotten there, you know, in the course of the attacks, perhaps prior to the last loss of lives by the four Americans who were there. So this is what they were so worried of. And then in retrospect, I didn't understand at the time, but with the hindsight of, you know, the ability of hindsight, this was right before the reelection of President Obama, and they apparently saw this as a huge vulnerability. I think, personally, you know, I'm not a political advisor, but if they had just come clean and not made up this whole concocted story, they could have gotten past this. I think Obama would have been, likely have been reelected anyway, but they apparently saw it as a big vulnerability, and they chewed on and chewed on it, made it something completely different, in which case, like usual, the cover-up turned out to be as bad or worse than the original deed.
What is the status of your lawsuit right now?
We just had oral arguments on my appeal. The Justice Department has successfully argued, we're in our fourth year now, they've done nothing but obstruct, haven't turned over a single piece of paper from our subpoenas, haven't given a single deposition. But they successfully argued that we had enough discovery that we should have been able to identify the names of the John Doe federal agents responsible. And we don't have names because, like I said, they have the names and they haven't given us a single piece of paper. But that's one of their arguments.
But is that legal for them? I mean, in discovery, you're supposed to turn over that stuff.
All they did was file objections. They said our requests were too broad. We narrow them. They said, you know, it went on and on until they convinced the trial court judge after a few months, only maybe 2 months out of 4 years that we were even given discovery. They went to the judge and said, look, this has been going on 4 years. They don't have names. We need to put an end to it. And the trial court judge, to my surprise, said yes to that and also said that Eric Holder, former attorney general, and other top officials are immune from lawsuits like mine.
What?
And it's true. Well, they do have, the government does have broad immunity from lawsuits with good reason in some instances. You'd have private people just keeping them in court 24/7 over every objection they had. But we're arguing, and we argued in our oral arguments a couple weeks ago, that we fit an exception to that, that if you can't hold public officials accountable if they improperly spy on private citizens, they're not investigating themselves with a criminal investigation, which is what they should be doing. So if you say you can't file a civil suit over this, that you've given them immunity from any kind of bad act of surveillance they commit on U.S. citizens in the past or in the future. And right. I hope the court doesn't see it that way.
So back to the climate of this, what I called squalorous, does this all really begin in earnest during the Obama administration, this kind of thing, or were against journal? I've just never heard of anything like this happening.
I have two answers to that. One of them is, I think it's gone on, you know, you remember J. Edgar Hoover was misusing intel against citizens, and I've asked quite a few people when that was all discovered, do you think the FBI destroyed all their blackmail files, held a big party and burned them all? Or have they continued to do what they did, but they've done it, some officials anyway, in secret and out of our public view? I don't think they necessarily stopped. But number two, it definitely, according to insiders, took a different turn under Obama. And that's when I was being told prior to 2016 that journalists and other people who they would never have gotten near before were being surveilled more routinely, and that they were using arcane laws that apply to telephones to apply to computers, which really broadened the latitude of what they allowed themselves to do in ways people don't understand, with laws that really weren't written to apply to computers. So I was being told that some years ago, and I think all that happened under the Obama administration, but also with the advancement of technology and everybody using computers the way we do. That all happened under the Obama administration. So whoever was president, this abuse or alleged abuse might have gone on as our technology changed.
You know, I want to ask you, those Intel documents that were embedded in your computer, classified documents. Do you know, generally speaking, what they were about? I mean, can you talk, generally speaking, what they were about?
I can't, and part of the reason is, without getting too deep, the source who discovered them was required to immediately remove them because he was a government person. And when he saw them, and what he claims is, he was under obligation to immediately take them off. So I don't even know what they said.
Does he have a rationale for putting them on your computer in the first place?
Well, he didn't put them on.
Oh.
He's the forensics expert.
Oh, okay.
So what I'm saying is there was a helper. Government insiders have helped me discover these abuses. One of them was a forensics expert who learned this for me on my behalf and immediately erased these documents, but put out a report for me as to what he found. but said that he was obligated to remove them.
Let me ask you something. I saw this great TED Talk that you gave on fake news and the provenance of fake news. I really would love to have you talk to our audience about that. Could you tell us about that?
Well, most people, if you ask them today, will say Donald Trump came up with the term fake news and has, you know, kind of spread it around the world. And I didn't know the truth of that, but I went back and studied it for my book to learn the origins. And most people are surprised to know this was a liberal invention that came as late as September 2016. People think it's been around now for years, but its popular use can be traced to the origins of a nonprofit group called First Draft that started insisting somebody needed to, quote, curate our information for us because someone needs to tell us what's true. If you can go back in time, we live with this every day now, but prior to that, nobody had been asking for that. Nobody had wanted curating or third parties to come in and help curate our news. A short time after that, President Obama gave a speech at Carnegie Mellon that said, information is like the wild, wild west, and somebody needs to curate it for us. And I'm thinking, I remember thinking at the time, again, nobody's asked for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Why is Obama leading an initiative? So it made me skeptical. And then you can follow that with a heavy narrative during the campaign, during the final weeks of the campaign, pushed by Democrats and liberal interests to apply to conservative disinformation. And there was some conservative disinformation, but there was also liberal disinformation, but they were using this only to apply to conservatives. And I think the ultimate goal is and remains to be censoring certain information online and on social media, as we are now seeing done. This was the beginning of it in 2016. So that we can't even see opinions that powers that be decide they don't want us to see, or they want us to believe there's only one viewpoint on, which I think is very dangerous. But I think the beginning of that was 2016, and I looked, followed the money, and I looked up who was behind First Draft, that nonprofit, and it was funded by Google.
Bingo.
And Google's parent company is Alphabet, and Alphabet was run by Eric Schmidt, who is Hillary Clinton's top campaign donor at the time. So I don't think it's any accident that this happened. Well, then Donald Trump, the wild card, every time they said fake news, he just pointed it back and said fake news to you like a boomerang. And pretty soon they were begging for him to stop. And now pretending he came up with it, but he just co-opted it. I call it a hostile takeover of
yep.
the phrase. They came up with it.
There's another menace out there. There's like the foundations like this terrifying group, Media Matters. I find them very, very ominous, Media Matters. And I'm sure you're familiar with them and their work. And the way they'll just target journalists and just go after them with everything they have. And it's almost starting to feel like what is the possibility for journalists to function with all of these predatory dynamics that are crushing, that we haven't really gotten past? What do you do when you have a big campaign? I've had one against me. Christina's had one. It's very hard to transcend. Everybody on these microphones right here, we have found ways to transcend, but it's getting harder and harder. I wonder if you have any direct experience with Media Matters, because I feel like they're kind of underestimated and underreported.
Well, yes. I mean, they are behind some of these movements we've talked about, and they do it under different names, which I track in the smear. I think I'm the one that's tracked the most about their several dozen organizations that they want it to look like there's so many grassroots people who are, let's say, against a certain story or who mm-hmm. want to boycott a certain news network. When in fact it's the same group, small group of donors that are connected to Media Matters, but they have all these different groups. You know, at the time it was Citizen for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, Blue Nation, nonpartisan sounding charitable groups, LLCs, websites, and they get them all together and gang up, let's say, on a news story or a news person on social media. And those who don't know better, like managers, will be like, oh my gosh, look at all this, you know, grassroots sentiment against us, and none of it is. You know, it may gen up some real grassroots after they get online, which is the point of the whole campaign, and then they enlist their blogger partners like Salon and Slate and certain usual Vox and Usual Suspects to publish their talking points. They train reporters to write stories and pay them to write stories with certain narratives that then get printed. It's a huge network. And the way to overcome it, I found, I mean, is just to call it what it is. When they attack you, a lot of journalists who've been subject to this just kind of curl up and just don't know what to do, especially because their bosses are susceptible to this propaganda. And I think every time that happens, you need to say this is an organized campaign by, sometimes you can trace it very directly, and other times there are hallmarks of it that you can point out. Call it for what it is. People are starting to get wise to that sort of thing, at least a segment of the population is. So
yeah.
I just say call it for what it is.
That's what, when our film came out on all the forensic evidence regarding TWA, anytime somebody would write an article that was like a hit piece or a smear piece or whatever, we would do a line-by-line rebuttal of it. And we'd talk about it when we were, you know, being interviewed and so on. We'd post it on the internet, and we would send it to the reporter and to the reporter's boss. And boy, you, after a while, I think word sort of got around, and people stopped doing that.
Well, you know what else? I've learned, when I worked at CBS, I talked with our lawyers a lot about this. Years ago, I saw this coming. I'm like, there are these multi-billionaire PR firms, crisis management firms, Media Matters, so on, who have got this organized smear campaign, even in advance of a story, to try to stop and controversialize us. And all we do, because we're busy gathering the news, is play defense. We're like really outmanned.
Exactly.
That's their job, but we're just doing our job. And I said, shouldn't we develop some sort of proactive way to respond to this so we're not always just after the fact kind of jumping on board? And we never did. And now that industry has really taken hold. I think of the news industry, as I describe in the smear. They've figured out how to controversialize and get a grip on stories and further talking points and send out their emissaries and control the news narrative in really shocking ways, but pretty much because we let them. And there are ways to not let that happen. When you said you would write reporters, I found CBS was not very aggressive in pushing back when false information would be printed about us. Once I left CBS, and one time while I was there, I will write some occasional pointed letters. You can't track down everything. But when something's super false and it's pointed out to me and I can find, you know, easily find the source of it, I'll write a letter and ask them to change it, and they do. You know, I would say I've met with 90% success in the requests I've made when someone has put something completely false out there. And again, maybe out of 1,000 things written, maybe out of 100,000 things written, one or two may come to my attention, but I do take the time to do that once in a while because I think it matters.
Well, I mean, in the case of the stories that you do and in the case of TWA, you're not just dealing with a press that's that has been reporting a false narrative forever and is trying to continue to do that. You're contending with the government agencies that are, you know, using that press to continue, you know, to refresh the cover-ups, as I call it,
right.
You know? And
yep.
So it's really, it's a big problem because it's a continuous, it's a big job. First, you have to do these stories, and they're hard to do. And then second of all, you've got to mount this whole offensive. It has to be an offensive campaign where you expose the malfeasance, because a lot of times you can tell it's malfeasance on the part of the reporter. They know what they're doing, you know.
Right.
So
I think what's strange, one of the things that's strange about it is, historically, pretty much all the investigations I've done and stories I've uncovered over time, they're similar stories, and they usually involve, even when you're going after a corporation like Firestone because they were covering up with Ford their deadly tires, there was a government element of that.
Yep.
National Highway Transportation Safety Administration knew about this, was covering for them in some respects, in my view. And so we have a history of understanding the government provides false and incorrect information. They did during the BP oil spill that I reported on, many things, very commonly. Yet reporters now, if it's something they want to believe, or if they're trying to advance a certain narrative, will just say, well, the government says X, therefore, I believe X. And I think to myself, when has X ever been accepted unskeptically? I mean, when did that start?
That's the official source reporting. That's
right.
That's exactly what I ran into. And by the way, this whole Mueller investigation, I mean, the official source reporting on that, that they have created this whole narrative based on an investigation that is based on something that the forensic evidence shows, meaning the alleged hacking of the DNC computers, right? That's what kicked off this investigation. You know that Bill Binney, of formerly of the NSA, and a couple of other tech geniuses got a hold of the forensic evidence on that, right? And they determined...
Nope.
Oh, listen to this, Cheryl. Bill Binney, who's a, you know, NSA tech genius, and a couple of other former NSA guys got the forensic evidence on the computer, you know, on what was going on in the computers at the time, and they figured out that it was impossible for the computers to have been hacked, that the speed at which the information was taken out of the computers indicates is exactly the same speed as somebody going to the computer, putting in a thumb drive, and taking it out via thumb drive. They had been trying to get this information, okay, to Mueller, to the FBI. You know, the FBI didn't even look at the computers. Okay, they just handed...
I know. I mean, isn't that... In what world is there allegedly a threat to our nation's security, as they claimed, and yet they then go ask for evidence rather than taking it? I think that's one of the strangest things I'd ever heard.
Well, I mean, it's a high sign that something smells. But to me, you know, I'm all about the forensic evidence, as you know. And when I heard about this, we had Ray McGovern come on here and talk about it because it was through his group, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. It was a couple of his NSA guys who got the stuff and looked at it. And he said, you know, they can't get anybody to look at the forensic evidence that they have. And yet this is what Mueller's investigation is standing on.
Well, 2 points on that. I had two high-ranking intel people tell me they worked under Obama, were very skeptical of the notion that Russia was responsible for that, primarily because if the intrusions, in fact, traced to Russia, they thought that was pretty good evidence that Russia wasn't responsible, because it's fairly simple, they said, to make an attack look like it comes from anywhere. So why wouldn't Russia make an attack look like it came from the UK? Why, if it comes from Russia... You know, it can be bounced from what they described. The origin can make it look like it was bounced all over the place. Why did it come from Russia? I thought that was interesting.
Well, that's what Binning... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, go ahead.
No, finish, because I'll tell you what Binning said about that, because it goes back to what you had said when you were talking about, you know, the trying to trace who was in your computer. He said he said that they left fingerprints, but you could tell that they were manufactured fingerprints,
right,
after the information was taken out. He said they were manufactured fingerprints that, you know, tried to make it look like it was like it was Russia.
Well, that fits in with just sort of this analysis I had from people who didn't look at the forensics but said it would be very unusual if Russia did that and then it traced to Russia. But secondly, I was going to say, there's not been that much discussion about, and I'm not impugning Mueller because I don't know him, and I have no reason to think he's doing anything other than a fair investigation because I just don't know, but there is at least the appearance of a huge conflict of interest with him that everybody seems to think is okay. Nobody's really discussed his grounds for recusal. Those include, if indeed, as this surveillance abuse from our intel agencies has been uncovered, much of it happening under Mueller's time as head of the FBI, if he needs to prove to keep people from sniffing around into former FBI practices, if he needs to show that there was legitimate reason for surveillance when there may not have been. I mean, poor Carter Page was surveilled over and over and over again and never charged.
Right.
So what was the truth about the grounds they had to surveil him? But in surveilling him, as you probably know, they could also capture people two hops away, at least, meaning all the people who talked to Carter Page and all the people who talked to those people who talked to Carter Page, which includes President Trump, of course. So they do all this. Mueller, it could be argued, has a vested interest in making it look like all that was legitimate so that people don't look at these alleged abuses that happened during his time and with people that he knows and worked for him and that he's friends with.
Yeah, great point.
That's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. But I'm still
talks about that.
That's right.
Mueller is just this. We're all in, people are in this trance. Mueller, and he has this stellar reputation. And he's Mueller.
Well, one other thing that bugs me, I'm like on a roll with you guys because you're bringing up so many topics I think about, but everybody's saying, oh, he's so well-respected by Republicans and Democrats. Well, remember, many Republicans hate Donald Trump. The notion that some Republicans like Mueller as well as some Democrats is not in of itself an indication that he is or can be or will be fair when it comes to a president that is unpopular among many Republicans as well, and that's often held up. And then the second thing is, every time I hear on the news, and how many times we heard this, people say, Mueller's office isn't leaking anything. Well, first of all, the people saying so have no way to know that. Maybe they're not getting leaks, but they have no way to declare unilaterally that there's no leaks coming from his office. Much has been leaked from his office. And every time they say that narrative, it makes me think that just the opposite.
Exactly.
Someone's trying to put out that he's not leaking, but clearly somebody's leaking. So why do they keep saying that?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I have to tell you, I am really stuck on the fact that not only did the FBI not take those computers themselves and look at them themselves in their own, you know, with their own forensics people, they handed them over to a company that was friendly to Clinton.
Right.
You know, and there's something to me quite bizarre about how, you know, before it was all Trump and the Russians, and you know, Trump certainly he's done a lot of business with the Russians and so on. Okay, I mean he has, so obviously I would think he wants to remain friendly with the Russians post presidency. He probably will do business with them, you know. And, you know, maybe that's something to look at. But before all that, there was Hillary and Uranium One and her secret, server and all that stuff. And that was just all broad brush. Oh, no, that's all okay. By these same
right.
people. And then all of a sudden you have the Mueller investigation. And, you know, the Mueller is connected to the Clintons.
And can't it be called interfering with our elections when the DNC rigs the primaries?
Well, and I've written about, actually the best reporting was done by a Politico reporter. It didn't get a lot of play, but I kind of rewrote what he'd found in the interviews he'd done. And many Democrats were working, including the DNC, with the Ukrainians. Now, the Ukrainians are against Russia. So is it any surprise that as they, I'll say, conspired or colluded with Ukraine on matters against Donald Trump and Roger Stone and so on, is it any surprise that they were against Russia as well? And I posit that some of this fighting about Russia may have been stoked by or part of the Ukrainians who have lobbyists here and who deal with people here wanting that to be an issue because they, you know, they are enemies or opposed to Russia, so they want us to see things their way. One thing you said about doing business in Russia, and I did a story about the foreign lobbying law. Many people, and I think this has been the weirdest thing that it's been presented that there's something wrong with doing business with Russia. If you think so, maybe
exactly.
we should pass laws about it, but Democrats and Republicans alike for decades have built hotels and conducted business and had energy deals
exactly.
and consulted for and lived in Russia and all kinds of things. There's nothing illegal or improper about it on its face. And now it's sort of like, wow, look at all the Trump people who had contact with Russia. And I'm thinking millions of Americans have contact with Russia. Democrats, all the prominent Democrats also met with the Russian ambassador, Kisling, I forget what his name is.
Well, in the State Department.
In the election year.
I mean, the Uranium 2 deal was, you know, Russia was a big part of that. You know?
Yeah, and just the idea that someone even said in that there was a report about Roger Stone gave polling data to Russia, and then was that true or not? And again, I think we're asking the wrong question. That's not illegal. If you think Russia shouldn't be able to get polling data or conduct polls, I mean, I don't think anything stops them from conducting their own poll in the U.S. we could make that illegal, and then which nations are you going to say can't do that, and then how are you going to make sure they don't use third parties to do it? Those are all questions you can ask. But as of now, none of that has been previously considered unethical or illegal,
yeah,
as far as I know.
And you know why that is? Because before that, there wasn't such a concentration in the media to get the media and these official sources come together to create a contextual headspace for the public that Russia is an enemy.
Right.
You know, I mean, and it's very, very interesting, for example, if you look at Saudi Arabia, you know, and this Washington Post reporter, on the other hand, you know, Khashoggi, or however you pronounce his name, you know, he gets killed by the Prince Salman, and somehow that all gets mushed into, well, you know, listen, we know the Saudis, but, you know, we have to do this business with them, you know. And so there's this sort of this relativism. The Saudis, who's, you know, their whole, the way they, you know, treat women and the way they treat whatever, you know, we can do business with them. But the Russians, oh, my God, the Russians, you know, and it's a manufactured
a relatively new thing.
Exactly.
I think in the recent past, the notion was, even among, for example, Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, that we wanted to work with them. I think there's a valid viewpoint, not that I know much about international politics, but that you want to keep your enemies close as possible, work with them on the things that you're able to. For heaven's sake, we are allies with Russia, I think, in World War One. I mean, there are things on which we may be able to do in common. I know the Obama administration and Secretary of State Kerry had more contacts with a Russian foreign minister than any in history in a short time period, discussing about how to work together in Syria.
Right.
And that's not necessarily improper or wrong or out of line, but all of a sudden, gosh, could you imagine if the Trump administration were doing such aggressive or having such aggressive talks to cooperate? It would all be portrayed as some sort of, you know, puppeteering and sellout and, you know.
Now what? Watch the Iran machine gear up now.
Yeah, I was just going to say, which what you just said, Cheryl, also begs the overarching question of all this, which is where is the factory where they drum up these? They can't really be called stories. They're psyops, right? They're psychological operations. They're big mushroom mm-hmm. cloud ideas like Russia Gate, and people believe them, and they kind of just take them into their soul without having proof, evidence, scrutiny. They come from somewhere mysterious, and that to me is the somewhat uncracked story about and you can see stories where the phrasing of the stories are identical across hundreds of that's so
media
creepy
matters
to me.
And its Media Matters and its network is the origin of some of that, and there are other groups like it. I talk about them because Republicans and Democrats alike cite Media Matters and David Brock as the most successful smear group of its kind. You know, sort of an admiration type of way, even among Republicans who wish they could be quite that pervasive and effective when they try to do stuff. But I also think when you said psyops, I have argued that there's evidence that there is an ongoing intelligence operation against Trump. And all the hallmarks, if you know a little bit about it, and I've talked to sources and I know a little bit about it, are there of operations that are specifically put forth to undermine the president. And I think the intelligence community is complicit based on, most recently, a couple weeks ago, leaks of classified information about meetings, intel officials, briefings they had with President Trump, material that came out designed not just informationally that could help our enemies, by the way, but
right.
material designed to embarrass and undermine him, for example, saying he didn't know that Nepal was an independent nation, other things like that that are simply leaked as if a psyops, like you say, to create this impression of the president, a certain impression about him. And that has shifted over time. You remember the initial one was a clown, the word clown, and clown, 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 carnival, carnival.
Right.
And then when he started to look like the nominee, he became dangerous and racist. And that's another narrative that didn't exist as far as I could see. He became racist, allegedly, Donald Trump, on a certain day. When
That's
a Media
right.
Matters group started publishing articles, they went from a different topic entirely. It may have been about sexism. They decided to pick up the race issue in 2016, pretty late in the campaign. And from that point on, he was a racist. And I look back, there's nothing in the record that I could find that was pervasive about anyone thinking that about Trump over 70 years. In fact, quite the opposite. But now, that's a common narrative that you hear from, I hear from friends of mine. They just think, you know, they say things about him spending a lifelong, his life as a racist and all the racist things he's done. Well, I trace that in the smear to certain dates and stories and times, and you can track it.
Well, I mean, I think, frankly, I it's the Mueller investigation. Whatever anybody thinks of Trump, positive or negative, I think the Mueller investigation, I think there's something very odd about it. It's missing key. I mean, all these people who have
Peter
been indicted.
There's
and
no
so
there
on,
there.
There's no there there. Exactly. You know, and
but
you
we're all
hear,
in it. We're all stuck in it. Our whole country's
Cuomo,
stuck in it. But what is it?
Cuomo, who's the correspondent there on CNN, you know, Cuomo's like, you know, the collusion. First of all, by the way, collusion, even if there were, which there has been no proof of that, collusion is not illegal. Did you know that?
Didn't know that.
Yes, no. And think about that word. That's not a word that is in everybody's ordinary lexicon, at least it didn't used to be.
Exactly.
But that word was chosen and put on the public stage, I believe, by an organized effort for a reason. It sounds bad, but you're right, it's not a crime, but it's something that you can use to taint and churn up and advance your narrative with, which is exactly what's happened.
And really, they're conspiracy theorists if we were to throw that word back on
right
them.
Right back at them.
Right?
Well, I mean,
someone said that to me the other day about something, and I said, you know, first of all, I wrote about this in my book, too. Conspiracies are often true. I mean, everything from Bonnie and Clyde to the mob are conspiracies. It just means two or more people, you know, getting together to talk about an illegal act. But the notion that, you know, some people are engaged in theories about conspiracies. Well, the whole thing about Trump and Putin is a conspiracy theory, and one that seems to be, at least as of today, completely unfounded in fact.
Well, have you noticed that, you remember Clapper and Brennan, who had come out and they were talking about the intelligence is showing that there was something going on, you know, the intelligence, just like they did with the run-up to the Iraq War, by the way. All the intelligence agencies agree that there's something there, you know, and all of a sudden they've sort of disappeared, you know, and everything just seems to be, I don't know, now very soon we're going to get the results of the Mueller investigation, but we might not make them public. And I thought,
yeah, it's very strange.
I want to make feels very important to me to say before we close. I don't have a clock.
It's 49.
Okay.
Good.
And Cheryl, thank you for staying with
us.
Yeah,
we really appreciate it.
We really appreciate you and this conversation so much. It's so important. But here's what I wanted to raise. With all of we've talked about the what could be, you know, like near fatal assaults and attacks on journalism, investigative journalism, the journalistic process. But you're such a beacon, a hopeful example of somebody who somehow managed to transcend all of it and come back in this new form. I want to know how you feel about that. Is this the best of times for media, the worst of times, or both? Is there a new? Is there going to be a new journalism that comes out of all of this? Do you think that you're very much at the vanguard of that's going to be viable for new journalists who are real journalists?
Well, I'd like to think so. The problem is we have, as I outlined in the smear, allowed our industry to become so infiltrated by the smear industry, the journalism industry. We're so intertwined that there are plenty of journalists who want to do this kind of work, but not that many places that want to air it as is. And
right.
I work with Sinclair Media now, which is a conservative-owned group, so I'm now accused of being conservative. I worked for three liberal networks, PBS, CNN, and CBS, and people at the time weren't like discounting everything I reported because they were liberal networks owned by liberal billionaire donors or guided by liberal policies. But all of a sudden, when you work for a conservative network, everything you do is supposed to be suspect, even though my stories you'll see on Full Measure are down the middle. But Sinclair is unique, and I have a lot of people knocking on my door every week from networks, and I've hired a few of them. We're a very small team who want to do this kind of work where the managers don't tell you what to do and tell you how the story has to come out, what you're reporting. There's an appetite for this. The question is, who will provide the platform
exactly
for journalists to be successful? I do think it will come. I get called maybe once a month by people who have the idea to start such an organization. And the problem with me is I'm just a news writer, reporter. I'm not a manager. I'm not a business person that can help start and advise on these types of projects. But there are a lot of people that are looking at that see the same opportunity. And I think if someone does it, like produces a CNN the way CNN was when I worked there in 1990, just the facts, I think people will flock to it, even
absolutely
those who want to. Yeah.
It's kind of a golden age for journalism because the legacy media, the deep state media, all the things we could call it, went so over the cliff and people are so disgusted that it's a perfect time for media to be reborn.
And
I don't even like the word media. What shall we call it? Journalism. Journalism.
Yes. And not just for the people who are disgusted and have tuned out, but I argue, some people disagree with me, but I've talked to a lot of people about this, even those who want to see what they agree with, so they watch Fox or MSNBC or CNN, all those same people would still turn to, I believe, an independent news source that just told the facts and that didn't try to force views down your throat. They would watch both, is my point. It's not just, you know, people that don't want to see any opinion. The people that want to see opinion also want to have a neutral source they can turn to.
Well, you know, I've always said, whether it's opinion or reporting, it doesn't matter what wing, right or left, that the truth flies in on. As long as it's true, you know, as long as what you're saying is true, as long as your opinion is based on some, you know, something factual, you know, you could tell reports where the reporter has done the job. And not done the on the one hand, on the other hand, reporting, and this is what this one says, this is what this one says, and here are a couple pictures, and I'm out, you know? You can tell when real reporting has been done. And I agree. I think people are dying for that, you know? And I think they're, like, one of the reasons I think they really, like, Trump became instantly popular. Remember when there was the first presidential candidate debate, and at one point Trump said, he looked over at everybody else, he goes, you know what, I've paid everybody on this podium money, he goes, including you, to and he goes, when I pay people, I expect to get something in return. And it was such a naked moment of
truth.
You know,
it is.
And you so rarely see that on television that I just remember I was frozen. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. It's like this Tourette's syndrome of truth. He comes out with some of this stuff sometimes.
I think the war, if you will, is really Trump versus the media and the American people versus the media. I think that is what is at stake here, more than the things that we talk about being at stake with his presidency. This is a presidency that's very much about the media and the deep, deep corruption of media. And through this, in this era, we're going to see who they are, what they are. All the wires are coming out. All these people at CNN who are FBI, CIA, they're not even trying to conceal it anymore.
Right.
But the entwinement, the infiltration of, it's not even infiltration. The deep state and the media are essentially one, or legacy
one
media,
same,
whatever
they
call them.
Yeah, they're woven into
it's
each other.
It's this rotten thing. It's got to just fall off like a rotten.
So one caution for the future as we wrap up is, I think one of the most dangerous things is this media literacy efforts and fake news exposition efforts, meaning people that are passing laws now in California, I'll be doing a story on this coming up soon, or proposing laws, certain interests that say, we should be teaching media literacy as young as elementary school so kids know what to believe and how to find real news, and
God
outlawing
forbid
fake news. That is the most dangerous thing, because that, that means to me that's code for, not in every instance, but in many instances, that's code for, we'll make sure you don't see research on vaccines and autism.
Mm-hmm.
We'll make sure you don't see anything about President Trump that
right.
we don't want you to believe. We'll make sure you don't see climate change science that may differ with what you routinely hear. That's an effort to shape us, and it's very, I think, dangerous.
Celia, tell
yeah.
Cheryl about...
I told Christina she was very struck by this when... I wrote a story in 2006, it was published in 2006 in Harper's, and it was an expose of AIDS, a very toxic AIDS drug, very corrupt research science and human experimentation, and it involved a drug that had been marketed to over 30 developing world countries that was extremely toxic and deadly. So it was a big, big bruiser of a story. And they all went, all the expected suspects went completely berserk when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And
medical and pharmaceutical stuff.
And the attack came out of South Africa. It was every last activist group and gay activist, pharmaceutical activists and grassroots and all the rest of it. And Harper's did not buckle. And the story, we had fact-checked it for 4 solid months. So we knew we were on solid ground. But it had catastrophic effects on my livelihood and career and psyche and so forth. But I'm still standing. But the story that struck Christina that I told her was that a couple months after this, they had an AIDS conference. They have these AIDS conferences every couple of years, international AIDS, and they all get together. And they had a panel discussion at a conference in Toronto, and it was about what to do about the future of science journalism after this disaster at Harper's, where this article came out that, you know, made us all ill with outrage that there would be any questioning about the U.S. government's AIDS policies and research policies. And it also mm-hmm. touched on the third rail issue about the pathogenicity of HIV and the toxicity of the drugs. So mm-hmm. in their panel discussion, they started to put forth, and this were people like, I think Marilyn Chambers from the Wall Street Journal, and the editor of The Lancet was there. He was actually a voice of reason. And then a bunch of very blustery, very angry
AIDS researchers.
Richard Horton, thank you. And they said, what we need to do going forward in the future is we're going to produce the journalists. We're going to create the schools through our foundations and our funding where we teach them what science, we produce the science
right.
journalists of the future. Almost from the cradle.
They're kind of doing that. Like, they make sure that medical AMA doctors now serve as sort of the medical reporters at the network, which was a change. And at CBS, that served the purpose of interfering with some factual reporting that, you know, is contrary to what they're taught in the pharmaceutical industry medical school's curriculum. And they could block stories or discredit stories. They've been placed at news networks, and there are doctors in many important congressional offices who are on loan to the Congress's offices, I believe for the purpose of, they run medical information by them, making sure there are not hearings on certain pharmaceutical and medical topics that they don't want explored, to discredit certain lines of reporting and questioning and investigation on
exactly,
medical drugs.
Exactly. Death knell. Cheryl, we love you. We have to let you go. We're out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're
Take
very
care.
Grateful to you for your work. Keep it up.